Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. That's a little bit of, it's not groovy music. Groovy music's a different thing. That's the Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin music. Every now and then we get Jimmy in and give him a whole pile of weird questions. And you know Jimmy, he's happy to answer them. He's got answers for them. So we'll get back to that. Jimmy, thanks for being back for another hour.
Yeah, no problem.
It's like the old days, you doing 4 straight hours with us. I remember you that used to be kind of regular for you sometimes.
Yeah, well, I enjoy doing radio, so always happy to.
Well, back to the weird questions we go then. And this one comes from Subtrick 4322. Mm-hmm. Could zombies get married?
Well, it's going to depend on the type of zombie you're talking about. One of the things that's required for matrimony is the ability to make a rational choice. And there are some zombies, especially fantasy zombies, the kind that don't really exist, that clearly cannot make rational choices. Now, I know there have been, and I'm blanking on the name of it, but I know there have been like zombie rom-coms. You know, where like someone falls in love with a zombie or they fall in love with a girl or something. But I know those exist. I've seen posters for them. I've never watched a zombie movie like that. But I have seen at least a few episodes of The Walking Dead, some of the early first season ones. And I'm pretty sure, yeah, the zombies in that, they're not capable of making a rational choice to embrace a partnership of the whole of life oriented towards the good of the spouses and the procreation and education of offspring. So they can't choose marriage, and thus they could not get married. On the other hand, and some zombies, I'd also point out, are actually dead, and dead people can't marry you. So for both reasons, some types of fantasy zombies could not get married. Mm-hmm. But then we've got to deal with real zombies, because I don't know if you're aware of this, Cy, but there are real zombies. They really exist in Haiti. Oh, yeah. I did a pair of episodes about them, of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. It's episode 159 and 160. And in the episode art for one of those episodes, I actually have a picture of a man who's a zombie. His name is Clervius Narcisse. And he was a native of Haiti, and this was in the mid-20th century, but he came in and to a hospital. He was having a medical emergency, and he died, or at least they thought he died, and they certified him as dead. And this was not some, you know, hospital out in the boonies. This was an American run hospital and so forth. So he had good doctors, and they thought he died. And so then his body was claimed and he was buried. And then like years later, he shows up again and he's alive, and it's Clervius Narcisse. And he explained that, what had happened was he had been zombified. In Haiti, the claim is that there are certain practitioners of magic, like Bokors, who basically use a kind of a drug to ostensibly kill someone, and the person gets buried, and then they come along and they open their grave, and they get the person's body out, and then they enslave the person, and they give them, may give them additional drugs to dull their mind and keep them enslaved. And and it is believed that one of the components of the zombie drug is tetrodotoxin, which is a compound that's manufactured by the pufferfish that inhabit the waters off of Haiti. And tetrodotoxin causes paralysis. It is, for example, you may have heard of the Japanese dish fugu, which is pufferfish. And in Japan, where they also have pufferfish, they have this dish. It's considered a delicacy, and it has to be prepared just right. In fact, the chefs who make fugu have to be licensed by the Japanese government, because part of making fugu is you want to prick the poison sac in the pufferfish and get just a little bit of the poison around on the fish, and it has supposed to have this tingly sensation when you eat it. You know, like you think about like getting pins and needles in your hand when your hand goes to sleep because the blood flow's been cut off.
Right.
Well, something like that. But if they get too much of the poison on the food you're going to eat, you'll die. They even have a Simpsons episode about this. But that's fugu. And so the belief or the proposal is that what the Bokors are doing is they're getting tetrodotoxin from the local pufferfish and other ingredients and combining them to make the zombie drug. And then they give it to someone. That person becomes paralyzed. Their heart rate goes down to almost zero, and especially historically, it's been easy for them to be mistaken as dead. So they get buried, and then you come to the grave, you open it, and a lot of their graves are above ground. So, you know, you open up the grave, you pull the person out, they revive once the zombie drug wears off. They may have gotten brain damage from the zombie drug, but if you're going to enslave them, you then keep giving them this drug to cloud their mind and make them compliant. And then you take them to your, you know, your farm or whatever, and you get zombie slave labor out of them. Various. And so zombies are a real social role in Haiti. And Clervius Narcisse is an illustration, because of the certification we have of his death, that this does really sometimes happen, or something very much like it happens. There are other accounts of people who were zombies and escaped, that are not as well documented, but, and there are also people who've talked about this who have claimed for, and I go into this in the Mysterious World episodes, it's 159 and 160 if you want to check them out, but there are people who've said essentially this is a form of punishment. When people get turned into zombies, the people who get zombified tend to be people who are societal troublemakers. And rather than just killing them, zombifying them and is a way to settle them down so they don't cause problems to society. And it's viewed actually by some Haitians as a form of justice to turn someone into a zombie. It's, you know, kind of like sending them to a work farm as a penal sentence. Having said all that, what about these real world zombies that that exist? Well, some of them seem to have mental problems and cognitive handicaps that would prevent them from exchanging valid matrimonial consent. You know, if they got too much of the zombie drug and it caused brain damage or something. On the other hand, others like Clervius Narcisse, he seemed mentally fine once he got off the zombie drug. at least once he escaped from, you know, the farm where he was, and he stopped taking the supplemental drugs to dull his mind, he seemed fine. And so I would say someone like Clavius Narcisse, yeah, that kind of zombie, he can get married. If he can exchange valid matrimonial consent, then he can get married.
All right. There was so much more to that zombie answer than I knew was coming. Thank you very much for the question, Subtrick 4322. Actually, let's take a break. We'll come right back. We'll get another weird question in when we get back right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
We should pray because prayer is conversation with God, and conversation is the only way to build a relationship. We need that relationship with God. We should pray and talk with God about what's on our hearts, what's on our minds, what's active in our lives, the joys we have. We should share all of these with God. Prayer is conversation, and conversation is the only way to build a relationship with God. It's the most important relationship. All of our other relationships depend on this one.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Weird questions for Jimmy Akin this hour. And we move from zombies to, let's see, where? Oh, to healers. All right, let's see. S. Madrano.
Which you might need if you've been turned into a zombie.
If you've been zombified, well, I don't know if that's the correct modifier, but you've been zombified, you probably are going to want a healer. So this is a very direct question, Jimmy. Straightforward for you. What person does Jimmy consider a healer?
Jesus.
Yep.
I mean, that's the obvious one to me. Mm-hmm. There are also other figures that are mentioned in the Bible that are reported to have been used in healings, but Jesus is the main one. So, and beyond that, well, there are more recent people who have been credited with healing. Some of them are religious in nature and claim to be channeling God's power, you know, and that's something that I don't dismiss as a possibility, because one of the things that St. Paul does when he's given lists of different gifts of the Spirit is he lists healings as mm-hmm. one of the gifts. And so if we have New Testament evidence indicating God gifted certain people with charismatic healing ability, I would expect some people down through every age of church history, including our own day, to have that gift. And so I'm sure there are faith healers today. You could call them a faith healer. Charismatic healers, you could call them that. I think that we'd want to be careful in discerning whether God really is using a person to perform, you know, paranormal healing. This would be paranormal because it's beyond the normal. That's what paranormal means. You could also call it supernatural. But I don't have a problem with this. I also, though, have not researched it in particular. So I don't have an individual today that I would consider a healer. I know there are various people who I've seen videos of who claim to be healing people, various Pentecostal preachers, for example. And some of them may be genuine healers, but a lot of them are also either engaging in wishful thinking and don't mm-hmm. really have any healing abilities, or they are, in some cases, outright frauds. And some of them have been caught, committing fraud. So I don't have a problem with this category of person. I just haven't done the research to identify any such individuals. Maybe if in the future I get some terrible, God forbid, but if I get some terrible disease that's not susceptible to conventional medical treatment, I might very well search out such individuals. In addition to those who heal in a religious context, there are also claims that have been investigated by in parapsychology of psychic healers, of people who aren't claiming to have a supernatural healing ability, but a natural one, one that's built into human nature. And there have been studies done of these individuals. Some very interesting studies, in fact. For example, back, I believe it was in the 1960s, there were a whole bunch of studies done on, and they've been done on plants and animals and humans. A lot of the research is done on plants and animals because you need someone who's sick that you can, and you need replicability, and in order to get replicability, you may not have a good supply of sick humans who have all exactly the same condition.
Oh, right,
that you can all treat in exactly the same way. So it's easier if you've got, let's say, rats, and you can anesthetize the rats and then say to the healer, okay, we've got these two rats here. We want you to make this one wake up faster. We want you to help him overcome the effects of the anesthetic. And you can do that over and over again without ethical problems. So that's been done. One of the interesting, and I know someone who did those kind of experiments a number of years ago. One of the interesting things they found is something called the linger effect. They discovered that, they would put the rats on like two different little platforms. And they, they could film all this happening, but they'd put the rats on two different platforms. But you don't want to always be healing the rat on the same platform. So they would randomize, which we want you to heal the right rat, or now we want you to heal the left rat, and so forth. And what they discovered is if the healer had been healing the right rat, it was like some of the healing effect seemed to linger on the right platform. And you put a new rat on that platform, they're going to get better a little quicker, even without the healer doing anything. So it was like the healing effect seemed to linger. And so this became called the linger effect. And there's even more research that has been done that involves something that looks like the linger effect with plants. In this case, there was a whole bunch of experiments that were done with pea plants, where what they would do is they would take a bunch of seeds, and they would put them in a controlled environment. They would put them in put a bunch of them in pots, and they would make sure that the pots were all getting the same amount of light and everything like that. And they blinded the person who was to water them. They all got the same amount of water. They had the same nutrients in the soil, everything like that. But they also put salt in the soil to make it harder for the plants to grow. And so they all get the same amount of salt. So they're all at the same disadvantage. Nobody knows which is the treatment group, and nobody knows which is the control group. And they're all mixed in together. They have letters that have been attached to the pots, and it's only after data collection is over do you find out, okay, A, B, and C, or A, B, and Q, or whatever it was, those were the treatment options, and M, N, and S were all the control options. So nobody during data collection knows which is which. But what they did was they had a guy who was a healer who said, I can charge water. I can put this healing charge in the water, And this would seem to be a form of the linger effect. You know, he's going to put this healing effect. Aww. It's going to linger in the water. And this is not dissimilar to using holy oil and things like that as part of a healing ceremony in a religious context. But what this healer said is, I can put this healing effect in the water. And so they had treated water that had that he tried to charge with the healing effect, and they had regular water, which nobody had done anything to. And the worker who puts the water on the pea plants does not know which water is treated and which water is untreated. But what they found was that the pea plants that got treated with the healing water, even though the only difference in the water was the healer had tried to charge it up, the pea plants that got treated with the healing water, they grew better. And once data collection was all over, you measure the heights of the pea plants, and they did better. So there is at least some empirical evidence that could suggest that some humans may have the ability to influence health outcomes. And so I mentioned that as another possibility. At least currently have some horrible medical condition, it's not something I've investigated specifically. So if you ask me what person, and notice that's suggesting one person, do I consider a healer? Oh, I would say Jesus Christ, the Son of God. He's the great physician.
S. Medrano, thank you very much for the question. We've got time for another before we got to take a break. So we'll take Brett's question. Does the Pope still hypothetically have the power to crown a Holy Roman Emperor?
This can be answered a number of ways, starting with a simple answer. No, he doesn't have the power to crown the Holy Roman Emperor because the Holy Roman Empire does not exist. And therefore, there is no Holy Roman Empire, so the Pope can't crown him. On the other hand, you could push a little further and say, okay, well, suppose the Holy Roman Empire came back. Could the Pope crown the Holy Roman Emperor in that case? Well, it would depend on what the laws of the neo-Holy Roman Empire are. If the candidate to be crowned invited the Pope to do the crowning, well, then the Pope would have the ability to crown the new Holy Roman Empire, the new Holy Roman Emperor. So if the invitation is extended and if the invitation is accepted, then yeah, the crowning ceremony could go ahead with the Pope presiding. On the other hand, you need to do more than just extend the invitation. It needs to be accepted. And I could understand a modern Pope not automatically accepting the invitation, because the church is in a phase of its history where it's trying to be neutral with respect to various nation states. It's tolerated, or at least continued, I guess that's a better way to say it. It's continued certain historical practices that speak to special relationships with various states, but it's very hesitant to do new things. But if I talked politics, I would lose half the people I'm trying to serve. And so the Pope has a similar consideration. And I imagine that if a new candidate to be Holy Roman Emperor invited the Pope to crown him, the Pope might very well say, thank you, I'm honored, but I think I better not.
That seems fair. If you are a friend of the Pope and he made you Holy Roman Empire, just a Holy Roman Emperor, just with no prep or anything,
snuck up behind you and dropped the crown on your head.
Yeah. And like, you, boom, you're Holy Roman Emperor. I just don't think it would stick. I don't think anyone would accept that, even if the Pope did it.
Yeah.
Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's weird questions with Jimmy Akin. Don't worry. I know there are people out there anxious now that the Pope is going to sneak up behind them and crown them Holy Roman Emperor, but it's very unlikely. That actually happened
in history.
Oh, it did?
Oh, yeah.
You got to remind me. Wait, who got snuck up on?
I want to say it was Charlemagne. I may be misremembering that.
Oh. Well, I mean, if you're going to pick somebody, pick Charlemagne. Not just the janitor or something. Pick Charlemagne to do it. Jimmy, what's what dropped on Monday or will drop on Monday? You could pick whichever you like on the Jimmy Akin podcast.
So this past Monday on the Jimmy Akin podcast, I had an episode on why Jesus used parables in the Gospels. Why didn't he just tell people what he was teaching straight out? And why does he say he seems to say, I'm using parables so some people won't understand? What's that all about? Coming up this next Monday, I have an episode on who was Jesus's grandfather, because people have pointed to Luke and Matthew's genealogies and said they conflict. Well, they don't. And Jesus's own family had an answer to this.
Check out the Jimmy Akin podcast, YouTube channel, or anywhere where you get podcasts. Right back with more weird questions.
Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers, and now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Checking my email during the break to see if I had been crowned Holy Roman Emperor, and I have not. I am still not the Holy Roman Emperor. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and all the questions are in because it's weird questions for Jimmy Akin. And this one comes from Seamus. If you were cast back in time, Jimmy, let's say to medieval Europe, you are captured upon the moment that you materialized in the past and were brought before the king immediately. You have an argument that you can present to the king to prove that you are a time traveler and not, say, a witch. What argument could you use to convince the king that you time traveled? If you fail at the argument, you're burned at the stake. Those are high stakes, says Seamus.
Well, I would say that it's going to depend on the specific circumstances, because I need to, not all kings are going to react the same, and they're going to know different things in different years, and they're going to have different mental options available to them in different years. So it really depend on the local jurisdiction. I'd have to know more about the specific time that that I've been transported to. I assume if this was a voluntary transport, I would have researched the time, so I'd know where and when I was going and who the personalities were and what, you know, the possibilities were. And I actually would contingency plan this before I even went to the past. You know, what am I going to say if I'm outed as a possible time traveler, or what am I going to say if they want to arrest me and throw me in prison or burn me at the stake for being a witch or something? So I would have this all gamed out mentally based on my knowledge of where and when I'm going. On the other hand, if I'm just transported randomly, involuntarily, and I have no ability to research where I'm going, I would, if I'm in the Middle Ages, now the Middle Ages are a very considerably lengthy period. They're between about AD 500 and 1500, plus or minus, depending on how you define them. But my manner of speech, if I was transported involuntarily, would itself be a barrier because I speak with an accent, as does every human being, because an accent is just a pronunciation scheme. But I speak with an accent today that would be the least of my problems. Even if I was transported to the end of the Middle Ages, like let's say I was ended up in Britain in the 1400s, okay, my diction and my vocabulary and my grammar are going to be different than what other people are using. And if you go back further to where, and that's even in the 1400s, that's modern English by linguistic standards. It's still not, it's earlier than the King James. So you can imagine I'm going to have some communication challenges. You put me back further into the High Middle Ages. At some point, we're going to hit Middle English, and then we're going to hit Old English, which is basically unintelligible. And before 800, we're not even dealing with English anymore. So if I've just been randomly, involuntarily transported with no opportunity for research, they may view me as a foreign idiot who's not able to talk properly. You know,
that's ungenerous.
Or at least just as a foreigner he's some guy, he doesn't speak any language like what we've heard. But assuming that, let's say before I go, someone sticks a Babel fish in my ear. So let's take the communication issues off the table. If I've been randomly transported, my first thought is I might not argue that I'm a time traveler. I might say, I've been bewitched. And I might start blaming a witch for why they saw me suddenly materialize. And I'm more than happy to demonstrate my Catholic faith. I'm not some heretic. I'm not into witchcraft. I ended up here because this is an involuntary transport, right? That's why I don't have it all gamed out. You know, someone that they would conceptualize as a witch randomly transported me here. It's not my fault. So I might try to convince them that I'd been bewitched rather than be a witch. On the other hand, if I decided to make an argument, I probably would, again, it's going to depend on the circumstances. If I've researched where I'm going to be, then I'm going to know the surrounding history. And actually, part of the research I would do and part of the contingency planning I would do would be to know upcoming events that are going to happen, but that are not otherwise predictable. And I would be able to make a series of predictions and say, I'll show you I'm from the future. This is going to happen tomorrow. This is going to happen next week. This is going to happen 2 weeks from now. This is going to happen next month, and so on, and build up a track record showing that I know the future, at least in this way. And that would help support evidence that I'm a time traveler. Also, I would be inclined, and I would, now if I'm transported involuntarily, I'm not going to be able to do that. at least in all, I'm unlikely to be able to do that because I won't know the historical period well enough. If I don't know the historical period well enough, and I was going to use an argument to try to show I'm from the future, and I can't predict the future, my next best bet would be to share scientific knowledge and say, and that can be demonstrated. So I might, for example, depending on where I am, I might be able to say, okay, if we go to this mine, we're going to be able to get some pitch blend, and I'm going to be able to show you some interesting effects from the mineral pitch blend because that were not known at the time, the ability to fog photographic plates, because pitch blend contains uranium. And nobody knew that before the 1890s. So I could use future scientific knowledge to demonstrate that I'm from the future. Now, that's not going to be a slam dunk. They're not going to, you know, that they're not going to accuse me of being a witch. But at least it would give me an option if I can't predict the future. And even that, you know, as I always say, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him think. If they're determined that I'm a witch and they're not open and they're just going to burn me, well, then that's what they're going to do. But these are some of the things that would help a reasonable person give me a chance to not get burned at the stake.
Thank you very much, for Seamus, for that question. It's baffling. You're sitting here trying to think. I don't even know what that stuff, that uranium stuff is that you were going to get. So I don't know what
pitch
I would
blend?
Do. Yeah. I don't pitch blend. I didn't know that it's full of uranium, but
it looks like pitch, in case that helps.
Yeah, that's okay. I'll have a hard time distinguishing it from actual pitch, but all right.
That's why it has the name. Blenda means deceive. So pitch blend. It could deceive you into thinking it's pitch when it's not.
All right, let's go to our next question. F-Man 6956 wants to know this. Is there any evidence that ancient humans may have reached a level of technological advancement similar to or even higher than ours, and that this knowledge was somehow lost after the fall or after the Great Flood?
Well, the short answer is no. We don't have any evidence of a comparable technological civilization in our past, much less one with higher technology than what we have now. Sometimes you'll hear claims to the contrary. Like, for example, there's a set of things that are sometimes called UPARTs. UPART is an acronym. It stands for out of place artifact. And sometimes people will claim that these artifacts betray a level of technological development that was not characteristic of the environment we found them in, which is why they're out of place. For example, there is a one of the UPARTs that people sometimes point to is known as the Baghdad Battery. And it's something that, hang on, let me get the episode number. Oh, I'm in the wrong spreadsheet. I actually did a Mysterious World on it, and people can learn all about it if they want. It's episode 308. So you can go to mysterious.fm/308 to learn about the Baghdad Battery. But it's an artifact that was found near Baghdad, and it's, you know, thousands of years old, and people thought, oh, this is an electric battery. You put an acid in it and put it together the right way, and it'll generate an electric current for you. And so people thought, oh, well, this is a sign of a technology that they didn't have. So it must be a leftover from some greater, you know, more advanced technology that has been lost, that, you know, most people in ancient Mesopotamia, which is where Baghdad is, didn't have. But the problem is that's not what the Baghdad Battery is. It's not a battery at all. It, in fact, is what's known as a foundation deposit. It's not meant to hold acid. It's not meant to generate an electric charge. It is meant to hold a little scroll that has a magic spell on it. And people in ancient Mesopotamia would bury these in the foundations of new buildings so that the building would succeed and be good for people and stuff. And so that's what it is. It's a foundation deposit. But when it was discovered, people didn't recognize that. And they thought, oh, you put these same components together this other way, you could make a battery if you poured acid into it. Well, that's just not what it is. So we actually don't have any good evidence of there being a comparable or more advanced technological civilization in the past. We do have evidence that goes back further of civilization than many people realized. For example, there's a site in Turkey known as Göbekli Tepe, which is like 12,000 years old, and it's advanced for the time. You know, it's a very impressive structure, but it's still a Stone Age structure. It's not as advanced as we are or even close to where we are. So it's more advanced than we thought would be what could have existed at the time, but it's still not advanced by our standards. On the other hand, just because we don't have evidence of an ancient advanced civilization, meaning comparable or in advance of where we are, doesn't mean there wasn't one. The idea that there was is actually something that scientists have thought about, and it's referred to as the Silurian hypothesis, after the Silurians, a race from Doctor Who of reptilian beings that existed at the time of the dinosaurs and then went into hibernation. So some scientists not believing that there was such a civilization, but they've still wondered about, well, if there was an ancient advanced civilization, say, at the time of the dinosaurs, could we detect it? Would we still have evidence of it? And they concluded probably not, because a lot of the traces of that civilization would have vanished. Due to continental drift and various tectonic structures getting subducted or melted down, or concrete crumbling, plastic decaying, chemicals, you know, returning to an undetectable state in the environment, nuclear waste losing its radioactivity. There are a lot of things that today we could detect that would indicate an advanced civilization that over millions of years would cease to indicate an advanced civilization. Oh. So I don't have any evidence that there was such a civilization at any point in the history of Earth, but if there was, we wouldn't necessarily be able to detect it.
F-Man, great question. That takes us to the break. We'll be right back with more weird questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I told him about the woman who came to me and said her two children hadn't spoken to each other for 2 years. Their grandma died and she was very wealthy. She left half to each one. She said they're arguing over a commode. She said it's inlaid. Can you imagine being in hell and somebody saying to you, what are you here for?
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Jimmy Akin, our guest. Lots of weird questions for Jimmy. This one comes from CJ. CJ says, not quite super weird, but oddly technical, so you might enjoy. We see what CJ thinks that you enjoy, Jimmy, the technical stuff. At the consecration of the Eucharist, the priest is reenacting what Jesus did. But it says he took, broke, gave, and said, and then an ellipsis. Why is the fractioning so much later in Mass? Why is distribution after the blessing of the blessing we are doing, what he instructed, should it not be in the order he instructed? Thanks.
Okay, so I understand what CJ is asking. So when the priest is saying the Eucharistic prayer in Mass, he hits the words of institution. And the words of institution begin on the night he was betrayed, you know, and it talks about how our Lord took bread and broke it. And what CJ is wondering is, why didn't he snap the host in two right there? You know, when he says, right, Jesus broke it, why didn't he break it there?
Right.
Because that has nothing to do with the origin of the fraction rite, which occurs later in the sequence of the Mass. The fraction rite fulfills an entirely different purpose. It is not meant to symbolize the moment that Jesus broke the bread at the Last Supper. Instead, it originated in one way, and it has a different significance in the liturgy today. The way it originated was this. Now, I am in Fayetteville, Arkansas, my hometown. The next town north of here, well, I guess you could count Lowell, but the next major town north of here is Springdale. And in the ancient world, let's suppose Springdale and Fayetteville existed in the early church. Mm. They didn't, of course, because America hadn't been discovered by Europeans yet, but let's suppose they were part of the ancient world. Well, churches wanted to show that they were in communion with each other. You know, we're all Christians, we're all Catholics, we're all in communion with each other. How do you show that? Well, the Eucharist is a sign of communion. If you can take a Eucharist that I, as a priest, consecrated, then you're in communion with me. If I can take communion if I can take a host that you, as a priest, consecrated, then that's a sign I'm in communion with you. That's part of why we use the word communion for receiving the Eucharist. So the Eucharist is itself a sign of communion. Mm-hmm. So what they did in the early church to show that they were in communion with each other is, if I'm the Springdale priest, I'd break off a little part of a host I consecrated and send it down to Fayetteville. And the priest in Fayetteville would drop it into his chalice, and then he would receive communion. He would do the same thing. He'd break off a little part of the host in Fayetteville, send it up to Springdale. The Springdale priest drops it in his chalice and drinks it. Hmm. And so this is a way of being in communion with each other. Well, at some point, apparently, they had a giant ice storm or snowstorm or something like we had here a few weeks ago that stopped the two little bits of the host from getting exchanged. In that way, it became impractical to constantly be sharing these little fractioned pieces of the host with each other. And so it's like, okay, if I'm the Fayetteville priest and the Springdale Eucharistic delivery hasn't arrived, I'll just break off a piece of my own host and drop it in there to signify my communion with the priest in Springdale who wasn't able to get me a piece of his host. And so that's how the fraction rite got into the Mass. It was originally a way of churches showing that they were in communion with each other, but for practical reasons, it ended up being just an individual priest doing this. However, once it became standard that I, as a priest, just break off a bit of my own host and drop it in, it needs a new significance. because if nobody's sharing these little pieces of the host anymore, then, but I'm doing it anyway, I need to explain it in some other way. And the way that was chosen, and this is what it symbolizes in the current liturgy, is the resurrection of Christ. Because, you know, Jesus's body and blood are not really separate from each other. Wherever you have his body, you've got his blood. But when Jesus was on the cross, you know, he bled. And so, you know, they drove nails in him to make sure he would. And so his body and blood were to a degree separate from each other on the cross, even though he still had blood inside his body. Well, that then reflects what Jesus did in instituting the Eucharist, where the host, you know, that signifies his body and actually becomes his body, and the contents of the chalice signify his blood and actually become his blood. And even though they were to a degree separate when he was dying on the cross, at the resurrection, they got back together. And they're back together today. So by today, when the priest drops a piece of the host into the chalice, he is symbolically reuniting the body and blood of Christ, and it's a symbol of the resurrection. So it has nothing to do with Jesus breaking the bread. It has to do with symbolizing the resurrection, which is why it occurs so much later.
See, Jay, I think you were right. I think Jimmy did like that technical question. Thanks very much. Here's another weird one. This one comes from Libby. How much water can a priest bless in one time? Presumably, they cannot bless the whole ocean. So how far is their reach in this regard?
Well, I would say that in principle, there's no reason why a priest couldn't bless an ocean in principle. There's a qualifier I'm going to get to in a minute. But what you're doing when you're blessing something is you're asking God to use it for the good of man. And so there, you're essentially praying over it. And, you know, if I have, this is not an ocean, but I've got a can of Zevia soda here. You know, if I had a priest here, I could ask him to bless the Zevia soda and ask God to use it to properly hydrate my body. Well, okay. If we had an ocean here, I could ask the priest to bless the ocean, and that basically that'd just be praying over the ocean, saying, God, please help, you know, this ocean benefit people. May it benefit fishermen. May it benefit, you know, oceanic explorers. May it benefit scientists. May it benefit transpo people. May it benefit all these different people, and may the fish in the ocean be blessed, and so forth. You're just asking, that's what a blessing is. Benedicere in Latin, it just means to speak well of. You're asking God to use this thing to do good or to make things well by using it. So I don't think there's any limit in principle on the ability to pray over anything. You could bless the whole universe and ask God to use it to do good. But I think that given that it has not developed as a custom for Catholic priests or other Catholics to do that, that there may be an implicit limit that is envisioned by the church's law. However, the church has not defined what that limit is. And so, so I would say that if a priest did like try to bless the entire Pacific Ocean, let's say, and make it all holy water, I could imagine the Rota over in Rome saying, yeah, no, that didn't have its effect. The entire Pacific Ocean is not holy water now. But thus far, the legislator, the Pope, has not defined what the limits of such a blessing are. And so I would say this is an open question that cannot be answered until we get further clarification from the legislator about how far he wants the blessing to extend.
Libby, you left us with a cliffhanger. We need the Pope to answer this one. Since he's not going to be assigning anybody Holy Roman Emperor, he's probably got time for this one. So Thanks, Libby. Jimmy Akin, thank you very much for 2 great hours of Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin.
My pleasure.
That will do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.